Since we're doing a show on euthanasia, I was actually thinking, you know, what kind of pants check can we do? It strikes me that we could do a burial suit pants check. Do you have your burial pants on, Mike?
I'm not wearing burial pants. I'm actually getting ready for the next emanation. So I have a shroud that I've
so
got.
So it's more like reincarnation pants.
Yes, I'm wearing reincarnation pants. I'm wearing a shroud.
Didn't they do that in ancient Egypt? You know, they just pack all your belongings, you know, your reincarnation pants. Don't forget those.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You don't want to be pantsless in the afterlife.
Reincarnation supper. You know, here's, you know, your two wives. You'll probably need those.
You could even take your cat with you.
Yeah, take your cat, take your bird.
So, you know, Data can take some reincarnated version of a mummified Spot with him.
Exactly.
If there's an afterlife.
Exactly. Good kitty.
This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 26 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frühling. In this episode, we'll be talking about Star Trek's take on the ethical issue of euthanasia, or whether it's morally permissible to end somebody's life to relieve pain and suffering. Zachary, this is a heavy topic. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing okay. It's actually been a rough couple of weeks for me, but I'm hanging in there. I'm not sure that talking about euthanasia is the best way to lift my spirits, but yeah, I'm hanging in there. I'm ready to talk about Star Trek and philosophy. This is we were talking before the show that Metatrex is the highlight of both of our weeks, so I'm looking forward to diving in.
Yeah, this is the fun thing that we get to do each week. So yeah, it's gonna be fun. Even though this is a heavy topic, you know, it's funny because I remember distinctly the first time that I ever engaged in a conversation regarding euthanasia. This is going to sound a little corny, but you know, I grew up in a really small town in West Virginia, and up until the point that I went off to college in Nashville, Tennessee, I had not really been outside my little town very much. And so I got to college, and there was another gentleman that roomed across the hallway from me who also was from a very small town in the South and in Mississippi. And we were having this conversation, and all of a sudden somebody interjected, you know, what do you guys think about euthanasia?
Just random.
We were talking about moral and ethical issues.
For a minute there, I thought you were going to say you had to euthanize your roommate or something crazy like that.
I thought about it a few times. I did, but no. This guy, he's from a small town in Mississippi, and this other gentleman, you were having this conversation about moral and ethical issues, and he just throws out there, "What do you guys think about euthanasia?" And I'll never forget. You know, my friend, he went on to become a good friend. He kind of got this puzzled look on his face, and he said, "Well." He had a very Southern accent. He kind of Trip Tucker sort of Southern accent. He goes, "Well, I don't know. I think the children are our future. It doesn't matter where they're from. So we need to do everything we can to help them euthanasia out."
Yeah, they need more education.
Yeah, you know what's really funny about that, Zachary, is he was completely serious. That's what made it funny. So
we have to be really careful to make sure we spell out what we're talking about tonight. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Euthanasia, euthanasia. IA.
You know, it's hard for you and me. You and I always have to resist the urge to give a Greek vocabulary lesson, and that's what we're going to do right now. So euthanasia, of course, is really comes from a Greek word. It's a conjunction of two Greek words, eu, which means good, and thanatos, which means death. So euthanasia, we're talking about good death. You know, what is the way to, you know, make sure people end their life with dignity and with minimal pain and suffering, and what are the ethical issues about that? But yeah, euthanasia, not the young people of a sister continent. We're talking about the issues surrounding, you know, ending someone's life with dignity.
Yeah, and when this topic first was proposed, when we were talking about it, I think we were both surprised at just how much Star Trek deals with this topic in the Star Trek universe. Just about every iteration of Star Trek has addressed this issue in one way or another, and really presenting fairly solid arguments for both sides of the issue. But when you talk about the Greek origins of the word euthanasia, you know, good death, it almost sounds like a Klingon thing. And there should be a Klingon word associated. I'm sure there is a Klingon word associated with this.
Yeah, it really reminds me of, most principally reminds me of the Star Trek TNG episode Ethics, where Worf wants to commit suicide because he's lost his dignity, you know, having been paralyzed because of a spinal injury. You know, Worf wants to end his life with dignity, with a good death, right? So, I mean, I can't imagine a more Klingon-sounding phrase than that. You know, if you think that euthanasia doesn't necessarily mean compassion, it means a good death, right? You can imagine euthanasia being yelled out by a Klingon. Euthanasia! Yes. Well, sounds Klingon to me.
Today is a good day for euthanasia.
Well, you know, Mike, as I was preparing a list of Star Trek episodes where euthanasia comes up, it was actually really hard to do because there's a lot of episodes in Star Trek that kind of touch on euthanasia but aren't euthanasia proper. Like, when we think of euthanasia nowadays, we tend to think of things like physician-assisted suicide, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the doctor that gives you a lethal injection or pulls the plug from the life support, right? And so there's euthanasia kind of in this strict, narrow sense, but then there's all these issues surrounding you know, suicide of various forms, like Worf committing suicide, this ritual suicide. In the Star Trek TNG episode Half a Life, Dr. Timmison is required by his society to commit ritual suicide at the age of 60. Mm-hmm. And that's not really euthanasia in that strict, narrow sense, but it's certainly related. What's the right way to end your life with dignity? And that is going to mean something different for that race versus for humans in Star Trek and whatnot. So I lumped a couple of episodes in that aren't strictly speaking euthanasia, but related in some way.
Yeah. Well, let's dive right in and talk about a couple of these.
Well, the one that came to mind right off the bat for me when I came up with the idea of talking about euthanasia tonight was Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. Mm-hmm. And of course, in this sort of mental flashback scene that's caused by Cybok's you know, mental manipulations, McCoy is recollecting having to turn off his father's life support.
Yes.
And so there's a clear-cut case of euthanasia, right? You know, his father is suffering, he's in pain, he's lost his dignity, McCoy can't stand to see him suffering anymore, so he makes the hard decision to turn off the life support, and we get to see that acted out, and of course, DeForest Kelly does a phenomenal job of acting the emotions of that experience. But that's the one that came right off to my mind right off the bat, because it's just a clear-cut case of euthanasia. To prevent pain and suffering and loss of dignity, you know, flip the switch or unplug the life support and let nature take its course.
I think what was so compelling about that particular instance from Star Trek V is, you know, in the course of examining Leonard McCoy's role in ending his father David's life, he revealed that they actually found the cure for David's illness, and I don't think we're ever really, you know, clued in completely about, you know, what the illness is. We just know it caused a lot of pain and suffering. And so, you know, Dr. McCoy's explaining that within just a couple of months of his death, they discovered the cure. And now this is something that he's, you know, he's lived with because, you know, ethically speaking, as a physician, he has pledged to do no harm. And so this has become something that has been a source of great regret for him. So you're looking at really both sides of this argument. You look at David's suffering and you think, Leonard McCoy did something very compassionate for his father. But, you know, he also has to ask himself the question, you know, did I give up on him too soon?
We're going to talk about this a little bit later in the episode when we talk about the philosophical arguments and distinctions related to euthanasia. But it strikes me right off the bat that one of the motivating factors for euthanasia is the desire to end pain and suffer or reduce pain and suffering, right? Mm-hmm. You know, don't pull the plug on certain people. If you let them go on living in pain and suffering, you're sort of increasing the pain and suffering in the world. And on this broadly utilitarian approach to ethics, the goal is to try to reduce pain and suffering for the greatest number of people. And that's an interesting dilemma, you know, where McCoy in pulling the plug on his father is intending to reduce suffering and does so in the short term. But of course, if there's a cure that's invented a couple of months later, then, you know, really what's happened is that you have taken away the potential joy of increasing someone's life in a fulfilled non-pain and suffering kind of way. And the problem with that kind of argument, I think, in general, is that just the future is hard to see, right? You know, McCoy had no way of knowing that there would be a cure discovered down the road when he decided to terminate the life support on his father. And the future is always like that. So any argument invoking the future and what the future would be like if something does or doesn't happen is always a little suspect because you just don't know. You can never really accurately predict what's coming.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of makes me think about the Voyager episode with the 37s. You know, all of those people had been put in, you know, some type of cryogenic stasis. And in some cases, you know, they were placed in cryogenic stasis because they were dying of something. So they kind of did the same thing with, for instance, in Star Trek: The Next Generation. You know, there was that same instance, and you know, here they are, they're being revived in the future, and their diseases are easily curable, and you know, now they have to adapt to, you know, to life centuries removed from their own time. So, you know, it does cause you to ask the question, you know, are we giving up too soon? So that's definitely something we'll want to dissect a little bit as we roll along here.
Well, while we're talking about it, Mike, the other, I think, main motivation for euthanasia in general, before we dive into the specifics of these particular episodes, the other main motivation strikes me as related to virtue ethics in some way, that it's an important virtue to live a life with dignity. And that means certain things, being mm-hmm. able to be self-sufficient or being able to be for Worf, for example, it means being able to stand on your own two feet and, you know, like a Klingon, right? And, you know, if people are losing their dignity in some way, and of course, you have to really spell out what that means. It's very easy to say, oh, you know, someone is losing their dignity. They're, you know, they're laid up in bed, they're paralyzed, they can't function, they're in pain, so they've lost their dignity. I don't think it's really clear at all exactly what that means. And in fact, in Star Trek, it means different things to different races. For we humans, it means certain things. Mm-hmm. You'd really, to give a full philosophical analysis of that, you'd really have to spell out what dignity means for these different groups. But in general, it seems like if that's one of the other motivating factor, if one factor is to reduce pain and suffering, if the other factor is to preserve dignity, then that's an argument for saying, look, you know, this is an important quality of life attribute, that if you've lost your dignity, that's not a life worth living. So it becomes morally acceptable to end a life that doesn't have dignity anymore. So, you know, in my mind, the motivations for euthanasia are just that kind of twofold, pronged approach. One is this utilitarian concern about pain and suffering. The other is this concern about living a life that's worth living, a life with dignity.
Well, and you mentioned the Star Trek Next Generation episode Ethics, and it causes me to think a little bit. I'm really surprised, Zachary, that euthanasia isn't more prevalent among the Klingons, because after all, a good life for them is being able, as you said, to stand on your own two feet, but even more importantly, to be able to fight on your own two feet. I mean, you're not a Klingon if you're not a warrior. So as Klingons age, and we see that sometimes they do, live to fight another battle well into their years. In fact, in Deep Space Nine, Kor, is gotten so old, he's become a little forgetful, maybe inflicted by a little bit of dementia, and so, you know, he's a man well into his years. And I'm really surprised that Klingons don't practice some type of ritualistic euthanasia for elder Klingons, considering considering their own sense of virtue and ethics.
Well, Mike, it's funny you mentioned that episode of Deep Space Nine, because if I remember that episode correctly, Kor ends up basically, you know, stealing the ship. Worf was supposed to take command of the ship, and Kor ends up knocking him out and taking the ship by himself, and ends up basically committing some form of suicide, on one final mission. It was a suicide mission to achieve a victory, right? Mm-hmm. You know, can you read that kind of Klingon approach to death, you know, going out in a blaze of glory as a type of Klingon euthanasia? It seems plausible to me.
I suppose you're right. Absolutely.
The Klingon way of going out in a blaze of glory, you know, I mean, yes, we see older Klingons in Star Trek, right? But these are Klingons that still stand on their own 2 feet. They don't see too many old, you know, really old, frail Klingons that can't function. I think maybe you're right. It's funny we see as many of them as we do. And certainly in the Klingon worldview, they're objects of pity, right? I don't think the Klingons really praise old people who are feeble and aren't able to function anymore. I don't see that very much in Star Trek, but no. It's funny we see as many of them as we do, but the Klingon, you know, the Klingons have this kind of death wish to go out in a blaze of glory. That is kind of a Klingon euthanasia, isn't it?
I guess to some degree it would be. It could fall under, you know, notable distinctions. For sure. For sure.
And of course, Klingons do have this death ritual that we see in Ethics, the Hecbot, I think it was. Hecbot, the ceremony, right? This ritual suicide that Worf wants to undergo, where, you know, someone's supposed to bring him the knife. His firstborn son is supposed to bring him the knife to plunge into his own heart. You know, it's, at least from that episode, it seems like Klingons have this as part of their culture, that when you get to that point, you're supposed to recognize it about yourself and commit this ritual suicide. It's different from a physician-assisted suicide. In fact, Dr. Crusher will have no part of this, of course, right? And Riker ends up having no part of this, although it seems like Riker is at least entertaining the notion to some degree. But, you know, that issue aside, it seems like Worf is taking it upon himself to end his own life, and that's, at least Worf's, you know, maybe overly strict interpretation of what Klingons are supposed to do. We've already mentioned in the past that Worf is kind of the almost too perfect of a Klingon. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, he's a better Klingon than other Klingons in a lot of ways. And whether this is a really robust part of Klingon society, we never really learn. Worf at least thinks it is, but whether that's true for Klingons in general, I don't think we ever find out.
Yeah, Worf is the very model of a modern uber Klingon. I think with Riker's issue in Ethics was trying to honor his friend's wish and his own moral wrestlings with the issue. I think for Riker, he certainly was appalled at the idea of giving up and ending your own life, but he so valued the friendship that he had with Worf that he wanted to honor that friendship. And so, you know, he found himself very torn. And I think that's a position that a lot of people find themselves in when you're dissecting the ethical issues of euthanasia.
That episode in particular, Ethics, strikes me as really complicated. There's multiple issues going on at the same time, and they overlap. I think one issue is, like we mentioned, the issue of dignity, of course, you know, whether life requires that kind of dignity. If not for people in general, then at least for Klingons. And because we can ask that question, is this relevant just for Klingons? One issue that it raises for me is this issue of cultural or social relativism. You know, is it okay that the Klingons have their own views about the value of life and what you're supposed to do with it at the end of life once you've lost your dignity? And that view is different from the humans' view that we see in Star Trek. And Captain Picard essentially says as much to Dr. Crusher, who's raising this issue, like, you know, I'll be damned if he's going to commit, you know, suicide in my mm-hmm. sickbay. I'll strap him down to the table if I have to, she essentially tells him. And, you know, Dr. Crusher tells Captain Picard, you know, Worf could live a very long, fulfilling life. Lots of people do. And Picard, you know, rightly snaps back and says, but not for Worf, not for a Klingon.
Yeah.
You know, is it okay that different races in Star Trek have different values on life itself? And so one issue is this issue of relativism. You know, how do humans view life and its value? How do Klingons view life and its value? And you could ask that same question about any race that you see in Star Trek. And presumably, if you go the relativistic route, there are different answers to the question and whether euthanasia is acceptable or not. The other issue is one of the value of life itself. You know, I think the humans that we see in Star Trek tend to have this view that life is intrinsically valuable. Mm-hmm. That, you know, regardless of your usefulness or your utility to society or the dignity that you have, the pain and suffering that you might be enduring, life itself, even under all of those conditions, is inherently valuable. And that's different from, I'd say, the value of life that we see in the other episode that we mentioned, Half a Life, in which Dr. Timmison has to commit suicide at age 60, so he's not a burden to his society. And on a view like that, it seems that the view of life is more instrumental or more utilitarian, more that life is valuable because of the role to play, the value you add to your society. If you can do things, if you can function, if you can be a resource, you can be a source of labor and not be a drain on your society, then you have instrumental value, practical value for your society. And so the thing that's hard here is that there's sort of two issues being conflated. You have all these relativistic issues, but you also have this issue of what exactly is the value of life. Is life intrinsically valuable, in which case you want to preserve it no matter what, right? It's very, very bad to end a life if life is intrinsically valuable, no matter all the pain and suffering you can prevent, no matter how the dignity you can preserve, mm-hmm. life itself is valuable. On the other hand, there's this view that once you've lost your usefulness to society, then you've lost your instrumental or your extrinsic value. And at that point, life doesn't have any intrinsic value. You're something that becomes expendable, or it becomes the right thing to do to commit ritual suicide. I think Worf kind of has this view. Dr. Timmison kind of has this view. And in that case, you really are the protagonists in those episodes are they themselves have this utilitarian view about their own society. You know, they think they're preventing pain and suffering for everyone else, their friends, their family, their society.
Sure.
And so it's the right thing for them to do to commit suicide so they don't become a burden and cause suffering for other people. So very complicated issues, relativism and the intrinsic or extrinsic value of life and whatnot. It's hard to make sense of that because I think all of them are going on simultaneously in both of those episodes.
Yeah, especially in Half a Life, the argument that Dr. Timmison makes basically deals with, you know, the relativism of their view on euthanasia. You know, once they reach the age of 60, this is something that he says to Loxana Troi. In the episode, he says, the resolution is a celebration of life. It allows us to end our lives with dignity. And of course, you know, Loxana is trying to get him to understand that his life is intrinsically valuable. And I think for a moment, she got him to really open his eyes to the possibilities that, you know, life for him doesn't necessarily have to be over. She represented the possibilities that exist in a new chapter, you know, a new love, you know, the possibilities that he may be able to continue his work and possibly much, much quicker than his people could even see possible, you know, perhaps be able to develop the technology to save his world. And so, you know, Loxana quips back at him and she says to him, you know, oh, you know, a celebration of life. Well, that sounds very noble. She's very caring. What you're really saying is you got rid of the problem by getting rid of the people. So she's really arguing the intrinsic value of life, whereas, you know, Timmison's only real argument is, well, this is just the way it is. And that literally was his argument. This is just the way it is on my world.
And maybe I think that's why that episode falls a little flat for me, because I think the interaction you see between Worf and Riker in Ethics seems to have a lot of substance to it in that way, right? Worf has really radically lost his dignity, whereas Timmison in the other episode, Half a Life, hasn't really lost his dignity. Yes, he's 60, but he's virile and he's functioning and he's contributing to society and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Whereas Worf has really lost his dignity. And Riker comes along and basically says the same thing. Life is intrinsically valuable. Yes. Look at all these people who fought to the very last breath that we've lost along the way. And I hate this ritual. and Riker tells Worf as much. And in Half a Life, Loxana Troi says something very similar to Timison. You know, I hate this ritual too. You know, I think it's shrouding this terrible thing, you know, cloaked in the guise of nobility. You know, you make this grand ritual out of something that is really terrible when you drill down a little bit. And then Timison kind of drops the ball and says, you know, I'm just not the man to fight the fight, and it's important for my society, and I don't want to be a drain and hurt my family, and I don't want to make my daughter cry. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, he decides to go through with the ritual suicide. And I, the contrast between Riker and Loxana Troi is very interesting, because Riker, you know, he's not going to go along with it. He lays the knife at Worf's feet and says, you're going to have to find someone else. Your son is the right person to do this. I hate this ritual. I'm not going to have any part of it. And Loxana Troi, at the end of the day, ends up basically going along with Timison's decision. He's decided to go back to the planet to commit the ritual suicide. Rather than saying, I hate this ritual, I have no part of it, she reluctantly, perhaps, decides to go be supportive because she cares about him, and goes beams down to the planet. And, you know, she doesn't, you know, fight him on it to the very last. You know, she's kind of resigned to the fact that that's what he's going to do. She's going to be supportive. And, you know, the reactions are between the different reactions between Riker and Loxana Troi there really have always kind of fascinated me. And for me, that episode, Half a Life, falls a little bit flat as a result. And I think the increased tension, the sustained tension between Riker and Worf and everyone on the ship and Worf about whether he should go through with this ritual is more dramatic to me.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Well, we also have some other episodes that we want to touch on. I noticed here in our show notes, Zachary, you have the Voyager episode Death Wish, which honestly didn't pop up on my radar. But after I saw it in your notes, it certainly makes sense.
So yeah, Voyager Death Wish. I almost decided not to put this one on the list, but because it deals with the issue of suicide, I figured I would put it on the list. So in this episode, I'm just going to read sort of the official synopsis. A member of the Q Continuum comes aboard Voyager, seeking asylum so he can commit suicide. Q arrives on board to stop him, leaving Captain Janeway to mediate a moral dilemma. And so this is not really euthanasia proper, right? This isn't a matter of ending someone's life to prevent pain and suffering. In some sense, you know, this member of the Q Continuum has some sort of you know, existential dilemma. He doesn't want to go on living in this infinite life, and he's suffering as a result, so he wants to end his own life. So it's maybe euthanasia in this very broad, you know, self-inflicted ritual suicide kind of sense that we've been talking about. But the reason I put this on the list, we actually learn in this episode that Vulcans commit ritual suicide when they reach a certain infirmity with age. And we didn't necessarily know that about Vulcans before. I'm trying to remember if there's a time when we learned that tidbit about Vulcans before, if this is where we learned that. It's not something that's ever focused on, not brought up very much, but in this episode, it's revealed that Vulcans commit ritual suicide, much like Klingons do, much like the race that Dr. Timison belongs to does. And so I put it on the list because, again, here's a case where maybe Vulcans, despite their sort of close affinity with Federation values, I would say generally Vulcans and humans have a very similar view about the value of life, although they spell it out very differently. And Vulcans, of course, don't get emotional about it like humans do. But here we learn that Vulcans commit ritual suicide. You know, this is somewhat in line with the Vulcan principle that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. Mm-hmm. This broadly utilitarian principle that if you become a drain in your society, then you should commit suicide for the good of the many versus the good of yourself or the good of a small number of people, just your friends and family versus maybe society as a whole. I don't think we learn enough about this to really analyze it in any way other than to note the fact that this doesn't just apply to Klingons, this warrior race and this race that Dr. Timison belongs to, this, you know, maybe sort of cold-hearted utilitarian kind of race. But Vulcans, you know, we don't normally think of Vulcans as having a ritual suicide element to them, but we learned that in this episode of Voyager.
Yeah, I just want to push back just a little bit. The distinction here that I think you made is that Q, or in this case, he came to be known as Quinn. He you had said that he wanted to end his life, but it wasn't necessarily for reasons of pain and suffering. But actually, his argument in that episode was, you know, eternal life in the Q continuum was pain and suffering.
A form of pain and suffering.
Pain and suffering. Which, you know.
Well, anyone who spent time with Q can attest to that.
Anyone who's ever spent time with Q would understand his desire to end his life.
Well, that's an interesting point. And I think, you know, what's fun about the Q continuum is they take these attributes of human existence and they kind of amplify them to the nth degree, right? You know, humans, I think we humans have entertained the idea of what it would be like to live an immortal existence, right? Wouldn't it be great if we could get 50 more years out of life or 100 more years out of life? There's always these attempts to try to keep prolonging human life. And, you know, we've been somewhat successful at that. The average human lifespan is longer than it used to be. And, you know, that trend will probably continue as medicine gets better and as we learn these more technical ways of prolonging life. But what if we truly had an infinite life? Would that be a life worth living? Would it become tedium or boredom or suffering or, you know, whatever it would be? Is that a life worth living or a life not worth living? And Quinn in this episode seems to make the argument that that infinite life that he's been given as a member of the Q continuum at a certain point loses its value and has ceased to be worth living.
Yeah. And, you know, he says something to Tuvok. He says at the beginning of the new era, life as a Q was a constant dialogue of discovery and issues and humor from all over the universe. He said, but look at them now. Listen to their dialogue now. And Tuvok says, well, I'm afraid I can't hear any. And he said, that's because it's all been said. Everyone has heard everything, seen everything. They haven't had to speak to each other in 10 millennia. There's nothing left to say. And he's so miserable. And you ask the question, you know, this is an eternal existence. Is that, you know, is that a bad thing? And my mind immediately went to Deep Space Nine during the first season when Sisko takes Kaiopaka through the wormhole to kind of give her a tour of the wormhole. And they end up getting pulled down to this prison planet. Kaiopaka dies. And there we later find out that there are nanites in the world on that planet that, you know, rejuvenate these people. So these prisoners who are there live a life of perpetual death and reanimation. And it's a and all of them only want one thing, Zachary, and that is to die. So there, you know, certainly the argument can be made that there are worse fates than death.
Before the show, you and I were talking about, you know, people we've known who have gotten old or have had, you know, some form of euthanasia inflicted on them, whether it's you know, something active like lethal injection or whether it's something passive like taking the life support off. You know, at a certain point, it's sad to see, you know, especially from, you know, if it's someone you care about, but there are definitely cases where I think where people have lose the will to live, right? They've suffered too much. They've lived too long. They, you know, life becomes, you know, tedium for them. It's painful. I don't even know the right adjectives necessarily. I haven't experienced this myself, but, you know, I've observed it in other people where the fight has gone out of them and, you know, it's more preferable to die than to stay alive. And like I said, I can't really relate to that at this point in life. So it's, you know, I don't want to be critical of it because I've never experienced that. But, you know, I think, you know, Quinn's character in that episode of Voyager has kind of experienced things on a cosmic scale, right? He's got an infinite life and he's, you know, take that sentiment that life is not worth living anymore, has become tedium and it's become suffering, and amplify that to the nth degree. And that's the situation Quinn is in. Does that help his case for committing suicide, or does that hurt it? Because, you know, a little bit of me says, oh, wait, please, he's a Q. How can he be suffering, right? He can snap his fingers and make anything happen that he wants. So, you know, I'm not buying Quinn's argument so much, but I do buy the argument, I think, of people I've seen who are radically suffering and have decided that life is no longer worth living. Well, Mike, just want to list a couple of the other episodes that we can talk about before we start diving into the kind of the philosophical distinctions that are related to euthanasia. Mm-hmm. One episode I had written down was the Voyager episode Emanations. And in that episode, the Vnori euthanize their own people who have incurable illnesses or diseases in this device. Is it a cenotaph? I think that's what it was called, cenotaph. All for the purpose of entering their afterlife, the next emanation. And in that episode, we learned that in this race, sometimes people who their families perceived as burdens were pressured into this. Like they had this, you know, intra-family societal pressure to, you know, crawl into this device all for the sake of relieving the burden on their families and friends. Very similar, I think, to what's going on in that TNG episode, Half a Life, right? There's, you know, that Timison in that episode is getting pressure from his daughter to go through with the ritual and whatnot. In that case, I think it's more for dignity and social norms. Mm-hmm. But in that episode of Voyager, your emanations, I think I really get the sense that in certain families, some families just want to brush away with the person who's explicitly a burden. You know,
yeah.
They're an extra mouth to feed and whatnot. So let's put them in the device and send them on their way and be done with them.
Yeah, that poor guy had a limp, you know.
It seems more sinister to me in the episode of Emanations for some reason to me. But, you know, again, I don't think I have much to say about euthanasia in that episode in particular, other than the fact that here's yet another race that has this kind of ritual suicide element to it. You know, it's some form of societal, you know, pressure induced euthanasia. And it's different from what other races do. So it just adds to this plethora of different races' views on death and euthanasia that we've already talked about. You know, I think this is every one of these we see in Star Trek kind of compounds the relativism problem, right? Each race has its own way of dealing with this. And who are the humans to come along and say you're wrong in doing it? Just like Riker is trying to do with Worf, and Loxana Troi is trying to do, she's Betazoid, of course, trying to do with Timison. They're trying to come along with a sort of more universalistic moral argument, like there's this universal value to life. You know, you're wrong in doing that. Your society is wrong. Mm-hmm. And they're taking a very firm moral stance in a very anti-relativistic kind of way. And, you know, here we see another one of these in Voyager. And of course, you know, because we start to realize that this is somewhat exploitative, you know, maybe not radically so, but it's certainly sweeping the inconvenient people under the rug.
Yeah.
You know, are the humans or Federation in some broad sense, are we right in coming along and saying it's just wrong? These races have a misunderstanding of the value of life, and life has some sort of intrinsic value that these races are not recognizing correctly. You know, is the Federation justified in saying that, or is that being too judgmental about other cultures?
Well, in the episode Half a Life, there's a conversation between Loxana Troi and Jean-Luc Picard, and he argues certainly for the Prime Directive in this case. It's not our place to step in and be their moral compass, basically, was his argument. And, you know, Loxana's not going to have any of that. Well, that may be your Prime Directive, but it's not my Prime Directive. She says to him as she storms out, and I love his response to that too. Computer, locate Counselor Troi. Yeah, Jean-Luc's not going to deal with her. He's going to tell Troi to go calm her mother down. But yeah, that was basically his argument. Do we have the right to step in here and tell these people, you know, what is right and what is wrong? And you know, to some degree, if you're going by the Picard standard of the Prime Directive, Harry Kim is way out of line. Harry Kim's kind of arguing to the other side, trying to get this, you know, this Venori to change his mind. You know, so Picard would probably dress him down for violating the Prime Directive. But I almost feel like Emanations is as much an episode exploring the afterlife and faith as it is an episode about euthanasia. So in that regard, it kind of falls flat because it doesn't really, it really doesn't do a great justice to either one of those issues, because it's sort of trying to deal with both of them in a 1 hour episode.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Star Trek is a little bit limited in its ability to deal with euthanasia well, because, I mean, you know, for a lot of people here in the real world, especially people of faith in any variety or another, the issue of whether euthanasia is morally permissible or not is intimately tied up with their views of the afterlife and their spirituality and whatnot. And even in philosophy, I think, you know, philosophy's general disregard for religion or theology as an answer to philosophical questions, right? Philosophy tends to prefer more rationalistic explanations and rationalistic justification than appealing to anything divine. Mm-hmm. You know, philosophy itself doesn't necessarily do justice to the to the connection between, you know, a person's spiritual views and their views of the afterlife and their views about whether euthanasia is justified or not. So it's interesting that episode Emanations really does try to deal with the issue of spirituality and its connectedness to euthanasia. And I think philosophy just plain can't go there very much, you know, short of having this really kind of, you know, radically divine command theory of ethics where, you know, whatever God says is right, whatever God says is wrong mm-hmm. is wrong. And if that's the end of the story, then philosophy, you know, that's one philosophical answer to what ethics should be, divine command theory. But, you know, absent that view, I think philosophy tends to ignore the spiritual aspect of euthanasia and death and whatnot. And at least Voyager, that episode of Voyager is entertaining the connection between the two.
Oh, absolutely. I definitely give you that. So Zachary, the last episode I think we have on our list, at least in terms of, you know, sort of our official list of euthanasia episodes inside Star Trek, is the episode Coda, in which Captain Janeway imagines that she's suffering from the phage.
Well, I love that episode because the doctor basically suggests euthanizing Captain Janeway. Don't worry, Captain. I can put you out of your misery if you want. And it was the gist of it. And again, this is not a serious, you know, philosophical discussion of euthanasia. It's just that, you know, that is one possible answer to suffering. I think, you know, it's not the only answer though. And I love that brief discussion in that episode of Voyager, because it just highlights the fact that there's always an answer to pain and suffering. You can just end your life. You can commit suicide. You can have someone inject you with something and put you out of your misery. That's always mm-hmm. an option. And very, very, very seldom is that the right option, I think, right? There has to be an extreme situation for that to be justified. And, you know, the vast majority of the time it's not. And I think that just raises an important issue about euthanasia, that I think one concern is that a lot of the cases that that come up in euthanasia aren't these extreme cases, right? There's someone wanting the lazy way out of their problems, or they've lost hope that they'll get better, or there's a healthier way to deal with the suffering, or they're not recognizing the value that life still has, kind of the situation that we see Worf in that episode we talked about, right? Worf is not recognizing the positive things that still could be in life. So that's the lazy way out. And Riker pretty much tells him as much. And I guess the concern is that, you know, euthanasia could be abused and overused to the point where, you know, maybe it applies in these really extreme situations, but it's always an option. You can always commit suicide. It's kind of this existentialist point, right? If life gets too hard, there's always an out, but that's not what we want out of our view of life and its value and what's right or wrong about ending a life. I think you run the risk of kind of undercutting the value of life in general if that's your go-to approach to ending suffering. And the flippancy with which the doctor says, "Well, you know, I can put you out of your misery, Captain."
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Highlights the flippancy with which, you know, the discussion about euthanasia could take place. You know, you don't want these casual discussions like, "Oh, you know, Grandpa is suffering. Well, we could just inject him and be done and be out. You know, brush him under the rug and be." Put him out of his misery and we'll be done with him and he'll be done with the suffering and we'll move on with life and everything will be hunky-dory, right? That flippancy is not, I think, what anyone wants out of euthanasia.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And honestly, I don't think that kind of flippancy really, it really exists for the most part. You know, there's certainly, and I think Emanations was probably an episode that, you know, she was almost all too willing to, you know, to get him off to the next emanation to do, you know, who knows what. But I don't think people take those decisions lightly. For me, Zachary, I tend to lean towards, you know, the argument of the intrinsic value of life. I'm inspired by Dr. Stephen Hawking. He inspires me. You know, does he experience pain? Does he experience suffering? Certainly. And there have certainly been other men and women who have experienced similar life-altering diseases who have who have opted to end their life. But I think about the scientific discovery and the possibilities that exist because Stephen Hawking is a thinking man. I'm inspired by Johnny Erickson Tada, who, when she was 18, was cliff diving with friends and suffered a terrible neck spinal injury. And so she was paralyzed from the neck down. And she struggled and certainly thought of committing suicide. That certainly entered her mind. But rather than look at her value in terms of who she was physically, she looked inward and found value in herself on the inside. And she drew a great deal of strength. And she's inspired. She's creative. She's a phenomenal person. And if our listeners aren't familiar, they should look her up and do a little research. She's an incredibly gifted woman, but you know, at 18 years old, her physical abilities, you know, were taken away in a horrible, tragic accident. And so, I see value in life. And like Beverly Crusher, I can look at Worf and say, hey, you know, he can lead a long, productive life. And that's just where I'm at on the issue.
Yeah, I think what's hard is that it's very easy to conflate these different types of cases, right? You have, on the one hand, you've got the people that you just mentioned. And I don't think either one of us would begrudge those people if they all of a sudden threw their hands up and said, you know, this is too hard, I can't deal with this anymore. You know, we can't relate, I think. You know, we're as non-disabled people who don't have those struggles, right? If someone threw their hands up and said, I can't deal with this anymore, okay, I understand that, I think. On the other hand, there's a difference between people like that who are living and functioning, albeit with a disability, versus someone who has like a terminal disease that's going to die in a week or a month or in 24 hours, right? You know, where death is literally knocking at the door and they're in horrible pain and suffering and it's an inevitable outcome and it's just a matter of sort of easing that transition versus versus the death not necessarily being a possibility, right? You know, Stephen Hawking, you know, maybe no one predicted he'd live as long as he has.
Oh, indeed. I think you're right.
But, you know, death wasn't knocking at his door immediately, right? And there are people out there that death is literally knocking at their door. They're, you know, they have 24 hours to live and they're in incredible suffering. And what do you do if you're a family or a friend or a doctor in that situation? So I think what's hard about euthanasia is it's very easy to talk about it kind of in the abstract, but you immediately need to kind of drill down and look at different types of cases and make some important distinctions, because I think our judgments and our intuitions for those different cases vary to some degree.
Sure. Well, let's make some distinctions. For instance, let's look at the difference. I know we were talking in the Turbolift, but let's talk about the difference between voluntary euthanasia versus involuntary euthanasia.
Yeah, I think this distinction is pretty easy to understand. Voluntary euthanasia is when the person who's being euthanized has consented to being euthanized. It could be in the form of a living will. What happens to me in certain kinds of extreme cases? You know, if I get in a car wreck and I'm end up brain dead, then don't put me on life support, don't prolong my life, or don't have extraordinary measures. But voluntary, you know, connotes the idea that the person consents to being euthanized in some way. The person requesting a lethal injection, that would be a type of voluntary euthanasia, versus involuntary euthanasia. You know, if someone is incapacitated in a coma and, you know, their doctor or their family or friends decide to have the person euthanized in some way, whether actively in the sense literally like, killing the person through a lethal injection or something along mm-hmm. those lines, or, you know, in Worf's case, it's the knife right into the heart.
Yeah.
Or passively by, you know, not providing nutrients or not providing life support or whatnot. In that case, if a person hasn't consented to being euthanized, and oftentimes it's because they can't consent anymore, they are brain dead and they've left no living will, and they haven't provided any instructions. And so someone has to make the hard decision. What do you do in that case? And then, of course, so you can make these distinctions. There's voluntary euthanasia versus involuntary euthanasia. But then, of course, the question is, what relevance does that have for whether euthanasia is justified? If a person requests to be euthanized, like Worf is saying, you know, bring me the knife so I can plunge it into my heart. Quinn, in that episode of Voyager, is saying, I want to commit suicide, and I'm conscious of that, and it's my own choice to make. Is that relevant for whether the euthanasia should be morally permissible or not?
Yeah, and that's you raise a really good point. And I wonder if let's play hypothetical. Yeah, I wonder if we had the ability to.
I'm sorry, I never learned to speak hypothetical.
If we had the ability to beam Worf here onto the bridge of the Starship Theseus, and ask him. You know, Worf, are you sorry that Riker didn't hand you the knife so you could plunge it into your heart? I would be interested to because we know the end of the episode. Some very, if you will, unethical medical decisions were made, and he was able to get a regenerative spinal cord made for him, and was able to have that surgically put in place, and he was able to recover. Mm-hmm. And Worf goes on to live, certainly, I think, by any measure, an extraordinary life. So I wonder what his thoughts would be about that particular episode of his life in hindsight. I think it would have been interesting for a writer to revisit that a little bit.
I think you raise an interesting point, which is that anyone under duress does not necessarily make the best decisions, right? And so if a person who's in radical pain and suffering is requesting to be euthanized, I think you can respond plausibly that person is not thinking clearly, that they're not being a rational being at that point because they're being influenced by the pain and suffering itself, right? They're not thinking rationally. You know, in the absence of that, they might make a different different decision.
Yeah.
And people outside might make a different decision. You know, hey, we know this person might get better. There might be another approach. Maybe life is more valuable than you realize. You know, all these other things you might think about if the pain and suffering wasn't so glaring and wasn't so present in that moment. It calls into the question the very notion of whether there even can be a voluntary euthanasia. If those kinds of factors are always such that they impede your ability to be a sort of a neutral, rational observer about your own life, is there even such a thing as voluntary euthanasia? Can you ever really consent to being euthanized, or is that inherently sort of self-contradictory?
That's an outstanding question, and I think it's one that I think it's one that, you know, deserves exploration. As we dive into this topic.
Well, I think Worf would say, you know, in retrospect, I wasn't thinking clearly, right? Yes, I thought I should go through this ritual and plunge the knife into my heart. But once I thought about it a little more, I realized I do want to live a life with my son, Alexander, and I don't want to plunge the knife into my heart. And I think he would just say, in hindsight, that wouldn't have been the smartest thing to do. Even Worf would probably say that.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, we sort of touched on this earlier in the discussion, but Worf's pain and suffering was physical. I mean, we can look at his suffering and we can see it. We can see that he can't move. We have the ability, even with our technology now, to some degree gauge pain, and so we can look at these factors and we can see suffering. But in the case of Quinn in the Voyager episode Death Wish, we can't see his pain and suffering. We can't gauge it. So again I think there are a couple of distinctions there. You know, what is pain and suffering, and what is its effect on us? And then, you know, while we are struggling with that pain or that suffering, are we able to make rational decisions? And I don't know that I have the answer to either of those questions, but they're certainly worth asking.
Well, you raise an interesting point that maybe this is an area where science can help shed a little light on the best philosophical answer. If we can actually determine, like, hey, this person is, you know, mathematically or measurably, you know, by looking at the gauge on the dial in sick bay, right? You know, is this person in so much pain that they're not thinking rationally or not? As we learn more about what pain really means and its neurology and biology and physiology, you know, maybe we can take a particular case and hook a person up to the, you know, euthanasia meter.
Yeah.
And decide, you know, is this person in so much pain that they're not thinking rationally, or is this person in so much pain that, that life isn't worth living anymore? You know, is that the kind of thing that science can help answer and kind of take this question out of the domain of philosophy and put it in the domain of the natural sciences?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. It's fascinating. You know, we were talking earlier about the difference between active and passive euthanasia. And, you know, I had as we've already mentioned, I've got a couple of personal stories about that, you know, both with my father and my grandmother. And I never really looked at either of those instances. You know, with my father, he was, you know, 49 years old. He was in very, very poor health at that age. And, you know, he experienced cardiac arrest, and they were unable to revive him in time. So he experienced brain death. And so by the time they were able to get him to the hospital and get him on life support, you know, he was mentally gone. In fact, we had 3 EEGs performed before the decision was made to discontinue life support. And so we wanted to be absolutely certain that, you know, we were only physically keeping him alive with the machine. And you know, the other thing is that we knew that he had no desire to be kept alive artificially. So, you know, that made the decision, deactivate the machine much easier.
But it puts
for
it
us.
In the voluntary camp, right? It's something that he had already.
It absolutely puts it in the voluntary camp. And, you know, I mentioned my grandmother earlier. At 83 years old, it was almost as though she willed herself to die. We had a conversation as her health began to deteriorate, and I very tearfully was kneeling by her bed, just begging her to get up and reclaim her desire to live life. And, you know, I remember her patting my hand. My grandmother and I were extremely close, and she patted my hand and she said, "My mother died at 83. I'm going to die at 83. And you just need to be okay with that." And
sounds voluntary as well. I mean,
it was very voluntary. Yeah. And so, you know, once she started experiencing organ failure several months later, you know, the doctor's saying, you know, she's unable to eat at this point. We could insert a feeding tube, but it's only going to make her pain and suffering worse and prolong the inevitable. And it was a very, very difficult decision. You know, I was with my mom, and we just agonized over this decision. But once again, you know, I went back to her words, in that she was okay and almost willing herself, to die. And, you know, she certainly did, pass away. But, again, you know, I've voluntary, but I never really equated those with euthanasia. In fact, almost until I saw the word passive euthanasia, you know, we understand that is letting someone die. I never really looked at that as a euthanasia before, but it certainly is.
Well, I think one of the difficulties in talking about euthanasia as a philosophical issue is that people tend to conflate terms that probably call for some distinction. So the question, if you take the term euthanasia and, you know, all the things it connotes, and you ask yourself, okay, what category does it go into? Is that identical to, or should that be distinguished from other kinds of actions like killing, like murder, like suicide, right? What's the relationship between euthanasia and these other terms, some of which are very morally laden, like murder, right? And that's something, there's an easy sort of moral case, like something's obviously bad, it's usually murder, right? So if is euthanasia a form of murder, or is euthanasia something altogether different? And I think that the distinction between active euthanasia and passive euthanasia, and the distinction between voluntary and involuntary euthanasia, seem to help avoid some of these category mistakes, right? If you have a case of active euthanasia where someone is literally giving a lethal injection or taking some active intervention to bring about a death, then you can plausibly say, well, look, that looks a lot like murder. You know, someone is actively causing the death of someone else, whether it's voluntary or involuntary. You know, if you take the euthanasia out of the picture and you say, you know, if you have someone on the street saying, shoot me now, and someone pulls out a gun and shoot them, you know, at very least that person would be charged with manslaughter, if not murder, right? So that we don't normally look at those kinds of cases as morally acceptable. So the voluntariness of it may not settle the moral issue. If it's parallel to, you know, the example of someone standing in the street saying, shoot me, I want to die. You know, if that's not a morally acceptable situation, why is the voluntariness of euthanasia any different? But In the case of passive euthanasia, where no one is taking an active step to bring about a death, you know, if it's just a matter of letting nature take its course and not intervening with any ad hoc extreme measures to preserve someone's life. So, you know, we have this phrase, letting nature take its course, right? That is kind of what passive euthanasia connotes, not actively bringing about the death, but passively letting someone die and not intervening to prevent the death, but not causing the death either. Then it looks less plausible that euthanasia is more like murder in that case, right? You know, murder usually connotes something active, like you shot someone or you did something to bring about a death. But if you're not actually causing a death in the case of passive euthanasia, then it sure looks like the parallel with murder as a case of moral terribleness, it doesn't hold up. So I think that distinction is really important for deciding which category euthanasia goes in. Now, of course, the counterexample would be, well, that's bunk, right? the counterexample would be like, look, you know, not turning on the life support system is just as bad as, you know, plunging, you know, a lethal injection into someone, right? They're both active in that sense. They're both a conscious choice, whether it's an active action or a passive refraining from action. They both stem from a certain choice to act or not act. And that distinction between active and passive may not hold up in the sense of it's like not intervening. If you see someone is going to get hit by a car and you just stand by and let it happen. In fact, we see this in the original series, the episode City on the Edge of Forever. There's a difference in that episode between actively pushing Edith Keeler in front of the car and merely letting the car hit her and not preventing that from happening. If that's a real moral difference, then this distinction between active and passive euthanasia holds up. But I think there's room to say, look, no matter what choice you make, whether you're acting or refraining from acting, that's still a choice, and that's just as much of an action as whether you are actively bringing about this physical action. So I'm always a little suspect of the difference between active and passive euthanasia. Like in the example we started the show with of Dr. McCoy in Star Trek V, he has to actively turn off the life support system, right? Yeah. It's not like life is, you know, life is going to take its course and his father is just going to pass away quietly. You know, his doctor is alive and stable on this life support system, and he has to actively turn that off. And yes, at that point it becomes passive, right? Nature takes its course and, you know, he's not intervening anymore to keep his father alive, and the father's going to pass away. But there's a difference there, the state difference between the situation on life support and the situation off life support. If you have to manually go in and flip that switch, even though at that point it looks like it's passive, that sure looks pretty active to me.
It looks active. It certainly does.
But I think, you know, if you have a different situation, again, you have to be a little careful because these are kind of contrived situations, and the situations we see in these exact particular cases in Star Trek. You can imagine a case where someone's brought into an emergency room and they're never hooked up to life support, and it's decided that this person doesn't have a chance in hell of waking up, and just to let nature take its course, and you never actually have that state change where someone is on life support and then off of life support. You know, if you just decide right from the very beginning, there's not a chance here, let's just let nature take its course, mm-hmm. then maybe there's room to say there are genuine cases of passive euthanasia through and through, where there's no active component, no active intervention, either in acting or refraining from acting.
Yeah, and I think too, because theoretically we can put someone on life support and keep them alive indefinitely, you know, that certainly was the case with my dad, even though there was no, there was zero brain activity, nothing in terms of brain activity there. We could physically keep him alive and in theory indefinitely. Dr. McCoy could have, in theory, kept his father alive indefinitely, could have kept David alive indefinitely with the machine. The tragedy for Leonard McCoy and for David McCoy is that the particular disease that David had at the time that switch was flipped was incurable. However, you know, within a couple of months, the cure to that disease was discovered, and so, you know, Leonard fights his own demons, as it were. Because of the decision that he made. And, you know, I suppose that had medical science been advanced enough to revive a brain, you know, a decade later after my father's passing in 1993, I suppose I would probably wrestle as well. But, you know, at the end of the day, you only have what you have in the moment to make the decision. And I'm not arguing that Leonard McCoy was right or wrong. I'm just saying, you know, he had what he had in the moment to make the choice. And whether he made the right one or wrong one is for, you know, philosophers much more skilled than I to decide.
I'm a little hesitant to make such an important moral issue like the value of life and whether euthanasia is permissible or not permissible totally contingent on the particular situation at hand, right? If you're always forced to sort of drill down and say, well, you know, in this particular case, you know, someone's suffering so greatly, or in this particular case, they might find a cure down the road, right? All these particulars we've been talking about the particular examples, that seems to contrast with a more universal Kantian approach to ethics, in which there are rules that are designed to govern large categories of types of situations, right? I'm thinking of things like, you know, just basic Kantian ethics. Murder is always wrong, or killing another person is always wrong because it doesn't respect the other person's autonomy, and it's not what you would want done to you. And just, you know, there's all whatever justifies these sort of more universal moral principles. Mm-hmm. You know, in that case, it just doesn't matter what the situation is. You know, if Kant is right that killing another person is always wrong, like, you know, you can take these moral principles. It's always wrong to actively intervene and in causing the death of another person. If that's a plausible universal moral principle, then it doesn't matter about the particulars. It's always wrong to bring about the end of another person's life when you can try to save it. And I think this is arguably Dr. McCoy's position as a physician, right? You know, the Hippocratic Oath, you should never do any harm. You should always try to sustain life. This is Riker's position in lecturing at Worf that he's not respecting the value of life, right? You know, it's not that this universal approach is foreign to Star Trek. I think it's too easy to read Star Trek as being relativistic in this case. There are plenty of characters inside the Star Trek universe who are saying, this is wrong. Life has intrinsic value.
Sure.
And you're not respecting it. So you're just wrong in wanting to take a life, right? And in that case, it just doesn't matter what the particulars are. It's always going to be wrong. And so these distinctions like active euthanasia and passive euthanasia, I think in that category, you can say, okay, if that moral theory is correct, this more universalistic approach, Kantian approach, then active euthanasia, no matter what the situation is, would always be categorically wrong. It would be more akin to murder and less like a compassionate act. But the problem is, I think we just have these conflicting values. We do have this sense of moral rules and moral rights and wrongs. We do have the sense of life as being intrinsically valuable.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of us, I think, have some sense of that, and not, you know, I don't think any of us thinks that our life is purely utilitarian and practical, that doesn't have any intrinsic value. I think you'd be hard pressed to find a Star Trek fan who really holds that position through and through.
Sure.
And then we have,
but at the same time, Zachary, I think if I were playing devil's advocate, here, I think the other side of that argument is, you know, Are we being moral and ethical by prolonging someone's suffering?
Well, that's it exactly. I think, you know, we have these conflicting intuitions. We do have these you know, more rule-based intuitions, but we also have intuitions about preventing pain and suffering, these utilitarian intuitions, and we have intuitions about the value of life and human or alien dignity in Star Trek.
Yeah.
And these conflict with each other, and I think there's just no obvious answer. And when you drill down into a particular situation, your intuitions can be pulled in one direction or the other. But the problem is that these are three really different categories of intuitions, and they don't conflict with each other. They lead to very different moral judgments, and it's difficult to adjudicate between them and say, in any particular case, which one of these intuitions is the right intuition?
Sure.
And I don't think there's a great method for, that I can tell at least, a great method for adjudicating between those, short of, you know, if someone's radically suffering, you want to end the suffering. If someone doesn't have enough dignity, you want to preserve their dignity. If someone is actively participating in someone's death to the point where it looks like murder, we want to say that's wrong. And we have those intuitions, but these cases seem to really conflict, and so do our intuitions. I think that just makes it really, really hard to know which general approach to euthanasia is the right one.
Sure, sure. Well, Zachary, we have gone well past an hour. Do you have any final thoughts?
Well, I think I just gave them in a way. I think that the hard thing about talking about euthanasia is just that our intuitions are pulled in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. And I certainly don't have the answer to this question, but I think too often I see in the discussion that these terms are being conflated. You know, euthanasia is too easily called murder, or too easily called killing, or too easily, sure, or suicide is too easily related to euthanasia, right? It's very important to make those distinctions. It's important to make these distinctions that might or might not be morally relevant to the justifiability of euthanasia. You know, if someone consents to being euthanized, does that make it morally permissible or not? I don't know the answer to that, because for all the reasons we talked about, but if we're not taking that into account, it seems like we're not doing our job in looking at a particular example in detail enough to give a truly compassionate response to a particular situation. Same thing with active versus passive. You know, the doctor who, you know, like Dr. Kevorkian, Dr. Death, right? You know, the doctor who's actively going out and finding people to kill, right? That is a different situation than the doctor who says, you know, this patient's got 24 hours and they're suffering and there's not a chance in hell, so we're just going to let them die. Those mm-hmm. are two different categories of situations, two different categories of agents in that case. So we do the philosophy of euthanasia a disservice if we don't make those distinctions. Now, what does this mean for Star Trek? I think in Star Trek, the danger I see is in going full-blown relativistic, right? Just because a certain culture thinks that euthanasia is great, Worf wants to plunge the knife into his chest, let him do it. I think there's plenty of examples of Star Trek taking this very hard-lined approach to the intrinsic value of life in general. Human life, alien life, microbial life, you know, new forms of life we haven't encountered, all of it in the Star Trek universe is intrinsically valuable, going out and finding new life forms, right? I mean, that's part of the mythos and the ethics of Star Trek is recognizing the intrinsic value of life itself. So, you know, I think it's too easy to take those situations that you see in Star Trek and say, well, you know, Klingons think this about death, so yay Klingons, you know, there's an aesthetic beauty to the variety of different views about death and spirituality and life and its value and the things you see in particular examples and particular races in Star Trek. But I really think that at its core, Star Trek has this core ethical view of the intrinsic value of life. And whenever those situations come up in Star Trek, there's always a kind of a Federation counterpoint. The Federation characters, almost without fail, someone comes along and says, but wait, life is intrinsically valuable and that's just wrong. And, you know, Star Trek is not morally neutral in that regard. So I think those are my final thoughts, that, you know, it's too easy to read Star Trek as being being relativistic and being and not taking a moral stance on some of these tricky ethical issues.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And I echo that. A couple of things that that we didn't get to mention. This ritual that we saw in the Next Generation episode, Ethics, we see pop up again in Deep Space Nine, in which Kern, Worf's brother, is experiencing his own brand of pain and suffering, albeit not physical. He's been rejected by his people, and he's lost his land and his prominence, his position, and he asks Worf to end his life, and Worf's all too willing to do it. But you know, his friends on Deep Space Nine get a hold of him, and in the course of things, he has a change of heart, so to speak. After Kern survives the botched attempt, so this actually pops up again. And then, you know, as we've talked about this, there's a whole other layer that we didn't really get to. That maybe we can talk about again later on if we ever revisit this topic. And that is, how does this apply as we move on to even other life forms? I know in the notes we had a note here about the animated series episode Yesteryear, which is arguably the best episode in the animated series. You know, in Spock's youth, they had to euthanize his pet Salot, and certainly many of our listeners can probably relate to that if they've ever owned animals who have gotten sick, and you know, they've taken them to the vet to have them put down. And so, and we refer to that as euthanasia. And so then you have this whole other layer of moral and ethical questions as it applies to I'll term as lower life forms.
Yeah, that's a really good point, that, you know, we've basically been talking about higher life forms, the sentient humanoid type life forms that you see in Star Trek, of course, ourselves and other races in Star Trek. But it's normal practice for a lot of us to euthanize other animals in certain situations, right? If their life is not going to be, you know, if their life is going to be filled with pain and suffering, and we don't want to see our pets suffer, so we take them to the vet and we put them down. We don't think as much about that as we do about human life. And so there is a really important question: what makes, you know, human or humanoid life so special that it deserves the special attention to euthanasia versus what is relatively normal for lower life forms? In fact, maybe that episode in the animated series, that episode in Spock's life, in Yesteryear, is what made Spock a utilitarian, prioritizing the needs of the many over the needs of the few, or his pet.
Well, I'm pretty sure that that was the moment that Spock decided to embrace the purging of his emotions. He just couldn't
can't
deal
with it,
Zachary. I can't freaking deal with it. You know, I got to purge these emotions. So I think that was,
of course,
the moment.
In philosophy, there are answers to these questions, right? Like Immanuel Kant. Said that it's rationality that accounts for a person's moral status, right? Rational beings in general, of course, humans, of course, but any rational being in Star Trek, Kant would say, would be entitled to moral consideration too. But it is the respect of another rational being as a rational being, just like you are, that accounts for that moral respect that you give to other beings. And other life forms that are not rational, that don't have minds or don't have souls or don't have you know, that same kind of capacity for being an agent, according to Kant, wouldn't be entitled to moral consideration. Mm-hmm. Even Descartes thought that, you know, lower life forms were just automata, right? They didn't have you know, any mental life. And of course, I don't think most of us think that now, but, you know, in the history of philosophy, you can find answers to try to distinguish between, you know, higher life forms and lower life forms in various ways. But again, I think in our contemporary sensibilities, I think those distinctions don't hold up like they used to. So what exactly does account for this difference in judgment between these human cases of euthanasia that are, you know, morally suspect to various degrees, and this relatively normal practice of euthanizing animals that we don't worry about too much?
Yeah.
Unless it's George and Gracie, in which case we would worry about it a great deal.
Yeah, we get upset over George and Gracie, and Spock over his pet Salot, going all colon R over that.
Well, it's been fun and maybe a little depressing even to talk about euthanasia in Star Trek, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And I'm saying this in a really good and loving way. Sometimes some things can't be unseen, but there is nothing cooler than Disco Bones. I mean, I know we're supposed to be in the 23rd century somewhere, but that was squarely 1970-something.
Oh, yeah, sure. It was perfect.
To the journey!
I think the only thing that we need to propagate in this new Star Trek show, and I feel like what Voyager propagated as well, is work together, become a family, love each other like family, and you'll be able to overcome any kind of obstacle.
And that is exactly what Voyager did.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Every single one of these movies has been good. So the idea that the first time that he's going to make a bad movie, like the one where he's going to drop the ball, is a Star Trek movie written by Simon Pegg, that does not compute.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all of the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and leave us a voicemail.
On Twitter, our handle is just @TrekFM.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/TrekFM. Also, while you're there, check out the Babel Conference. Simply type The Babel Conference. That's Babel into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at Trek.FM and click discussion on the menu bar. That's our listeners-only discussion group. It is a closed group, but if you click the join button, we'll let you right on in, join in on the discussion, and talk to us about this episode or anything else going on around the Trek FM network.
Yeah, it's a great place to continue the discussion and talk with us about Star Trek and philosophy, and talk with the listeners of other Trek FM shows about any aspect of the Star Trek universe that suits your fancy. We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you are not revising your living will and consenting to voluntary euthanasia, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network these days?
Well, Zachary, you can always find me around Facebook. That's where I'm most active, and certainly in the Babel Conference. Also on Twitter, my handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not sitting and pondering your journey to the next emanation, where can our listeners find you around the interwebs?
Well, likewise, probably the best place to get in touch with me to talk about Star Trek and philosophy is in Trek FM's listeners group, the Babel Conference that we just mentioned. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's ZacharyFruhling. We'd also like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Dennis Costello, our editor and producer. And we'd also like to give a special thanks to our associate producer, Patrick Devlin. We really want to thank you, Patrick, for your support of Metatreks and for Trek FM in general. And if you'd like to get in touch with Patrick, you can find him on Twitter under the handle @MagicDrop5. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to Metatreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.